nothing to eat, he called his disciples to him and said to them, I have compassion on the crowd because they have been with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat. And if I send them away hungry to their homes, they will faint on the way. And some of them have come from far away. And his disciples answered him, how can one feed these people with bread here in this desolate place? And he asked them, how many loaves do you have? They said, 7. And he directed the crowd to sit down on the ground. And he took the 7 loaves, and having given thanks, he broke them and gave them to his disciples to set before the people. And they set them before the crowd. And they had a few small fish. And having blessed them, he said that these also should be set before them. And they ate and were satisfied. And they took up the broken pieces left over, 7 baskets full. And there were about 4,000 people. And he sent them away. And immediately he got into the boat with his disciples and went to the district of Dalmanutha. The Pharisees came and began to argue with him, seeking from him a sign from heaven to test him. And he sighed deeply in his spirit and said, why does this generation seek a sign? Truly I say to you, no sign will be given to this generation. And he left them, got into the boat again, and went to the other side. Now they had forgotten to bring bread, and they had only 1 loaf with them in the boat. And he cautioned them, saying, watch out, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. And they began discussing with one another the fact that they had no bread. And Jesus, aware of this, said to them, why are you discussing the fact that you have no bread? Do you not yet perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Having eyes, do you not see? And having ears, do you not hear? Do you not remember? Remember when I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take up? They said to him, 12. And the 7 for the 4,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take up? And they said to him, 7. And he said to them, do you not yet understand? This is God's word.
All right. Thank you, Vi. And now may the words of my mouth and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. I just want to acknowledge really quick that when I wrote this sermon earlier in the week, the extended preamble was not tied on to the day and the heavy question hadn't happened. So, you know, thank you. You're doing the marathon today and I really appreciate it. I might have written like a 20-minute sermon if I'd known, but I didn't, didn't have time to change it. So here we are. We are studying for the year the book of Mark, looking at the disciples' encounters with Jesus, and we're asking what would it be like for us to encounter Jesus, and we're actually hearing stories of encounters with Jesus from people on weeks when we have a good fit. And this week we have 2. So as I said, marathon. But it's great, broken up with so many stories and unique elements. So today, and if you've been around for the year and you're hearing what Vi read to us, you're going, we already did this story. We already did this, like feeding on a hill. But no, there's 2. In the book of Mark, it happens twice. And it's pretty clear that it's not just a recycling of the same story. It's actually a second time that a miraculous feeding like this occurs. So it must be pointing us to something. It must matter. There must be a reason for the 2 feedings, and there must be a reason there are 2 stories today, right? So this evening, I am going to actually start with Michaela, my wife, who has a story, and you can come up, about a sign that God gave her. So today is about signs, about Jesus giving signs. And Michaela's is so on theme that it's literally a sign, literally a billboard. And so she's going to tell you that story before we jump in.
Check. Oh, perfect. Okay. So this story happened, particular story happened 2008, so quite a while ago. And just a little bit of background leading up to this. 2 years prior, I had graduated from college and didn't really want to do anything in the area that I had graduated in, not specifically. I'd also just gone through a really difficult breakup and working three jobs. I was, I don't know, just in this place where I was just disappointed and just wrestling with how life wasn't kind of turning out the way I'd expected it to, especially after graduation, and almost kind of grieving that in a sense, and just struggling to kind of, you know, obviously work, survive, and then also try to figure out what I wanted to do in the meantime. And so I started thinking about, you know, areas of interest. Had like four different areas I was thinking of, no overlap really whatsoever. I think it was music education, speech pathology, nursing, and something in linguistics, thinking about maybe doing missions. So thinking about all of that, I had gotten advice from friends and family to just seek out shadowing opportunities, talk to people you know, get what their experience is, get feedback, pray about it, which I had been doing. And really also, I was just really struggling with trying to decide what I should do. Like, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? And also really struggling with decision-making at the time, too. I would just get really paralyzed by the daunting task of making a decision where I felt like my whole life could change and it was just all in my hands. So I was just scared. I was in a season of figuring life out. I was scared working, you know, three different jobs, one of which I really just disliked. I was a bank teller at Wells Fargo. And I also, I came to this point where I was really needing to decide kind of movement forward. Was I going to continue with a couple different jobs? I had deadlines I had to decide. Was I going to, you know, go into school in the fall, get another deadline, and just really not sure of what to do. One day I was working, this was at Wells Fargo, and it was just especially a difficult day. Left, got into my car, and I just broke down. I was crying, and also just, I mean, literally crying out to God, just, will you please just give me some clarity and wisdom as to what I should do? Because I just really don't know. I could go all these different directions, and I'm just not sure what to do at this point. I'm crying pretty hard, leaving the parking lot. So this is the Wells Fargo on 5th and what used to be the Wells Fargo on 5th and Wilmot. Took a left onto 5th, going west towards home, and probably shouldn't have been driving, crying as much as I was. But I remember specifically looking down, crying. I had just turned. And then I look up, and there's a huge billboard to my right that says Nurses Wanted. And it was one of those moments where it did really feel like it was a supernatural moment. And it was like my breath stopped, peace and clarity just kind of washed over my mind and my heart. And it was just one of those things where I was like, that was from you, God. And thank you. So I continued forward in that path, eventually went to nursing school, been working as a nurse for 12 years. And also just thinking of the goodness of God leading me in that direction where he knew I needed to work on some things in my heart, and also wanted to have me experience some joys that I'd never experienced before, and so leading me in a direction where he knew I needed to grow, but also I would just experience so much of who he is, too. And then looking back, even Andy had asked me to share, and as I was kind of revisiting this experience, I went back to the area, and I was like, I don't see any billboards. And we went back, and we actually went back together, too, and couldn't find any evidence of there being any billboard at any time there. Maybe there was, maybe there wasn't. But whatever the case, God caused me to notice this billboard that he brought into view for me to give me direction.
Yeah, thank you, Michaela, for sharing that. I know that's a precious story to you and a significant reminder that God is involved in your life and cares for you. And as she and I have discussed, the presence of the actual billboard, I guess, isn't really the big idea, right? In fact, there's like a lot of power lines. I don't think there was a billboard. but it's more that God, in the moment she was crying out, showed her what she needed to see, right? So that's the theme of this sign, is that it's not just that there was a sign of God, it's that the sign was communicating God's care for these people. This is the second feeding of a large group of people in our scripture in a short amount of time. The first one, by the way, if you didn't hear our sermon on it, it's one that I think would be worth looking back at, June 16th. We unpacked it a little bit there. And there are key differences between the two feedings, but the core of the two is exactly the same, in that Jesus initiates the idea of taking care of these people out of his compassion for them. It says he cares for the crowds of people. In our sermon in June, I said the biggest miracle of all was not the making of bread. The biggest miracle, the most surprising layer of that event, is that if this is a God standing among people, that his posture toward them is to be concerned about their physical needs, their basic needs, and to go out of his way, even when he is feeling exhausted and trying to retreat, to take them in, to care for them, and to grant them what they need, even if it's just the basics, just bread. And Michaela's story illustrates a similar thing. She just needed help making a decision, which was hard for her to do. It's absolutely shocking in their day especially that a God would not come down and make them serve him, right? Or be the prophet or the holy man or the sage who says, follow me, go tell everybody about me. Jesus is always saying, be quiet, you don't need to tell anybody, and he's serving them. It's quite shocking. Seems very backwards. He's not demanding anything. He's just being kind. Now to the differences. I'm going to read it back so we can recall it, and we'll pause for a few observations. So as Vi just read, in those days when a great crowd had gathered, they had nothing to eat, and he called his disciples to him and said to them, I have compassion on the crowd. They've been with me now for 3 days and have nothing to eat. And if I send them away hungry to their homes, they'll faint on the way. And some of them have come from far away. So where are we? Jesus, we've talked about recently, and we showed some maps in the last couple weeks, has gone up the coast toward an area called Tyre and Sidon. And this is out of Jewish territory up into very like secular pagan territory, you could call it. And now he's kind of gone up toward Sidon, and now he's coming back down toward the Sea of Galilee, toward an area called Dalmanutha, which is near, we believe, the northwest corner of the Sea of Galilee, but he's still not in Jewish territory. He's with people who are outsiders to the religion that he grew up in, that he represents, to the scriptures that he has been referring to and that he has been shaped by. He's with outsiders. The last feeding of the 5,000 people was in the opposite kind of territory. It was in Jewish territory. And there are these allusions to like taking them up on a mountain and gathering them in groups similar to the groups that Moses gathered when the people were in the wilderness. There was all this kind of Jewish language and symbolism layered over that first one when you looked deeper. And this time, it's different. Those symbolic elements aren't there. Jesus had talked about them being like sheep without a shepherd, which was quoting from the book of Isaiah. This time, he doesn't use that kind of language. He's speaking about them as if they're not connected to the Jewish faith. It goes on and says, his disciples answered him, how can one feed these people with bread here in this desolate place? And he asked them, how many loaves do you have? They said, seven. He directed the crowd to sit on the ground. He took the seven loaves, and having given thanks, he broke them and gave them to his disciples to set before the people. They set them before the crowd, and they had a few small fish. The fish always seemed to be an addendum, by the way. I love fish, but it's always an addendum. Having blessed them, he said that these also should be set before them, and they ate and were satisfied, and they took up the broken pieces left over, 7 baskets full, and there were about 4,000 people, and he sent them away. There are some other differences. They might seem small. This might seem like minutiae to some degree. We could be tempted to think they're insignificant, but the fact that Mark, who tells these short, punchy stories, I've talked about this throughout the year, he tells these very short, punchy stories. If he's going into extended detail, it's probably for a reason. So here's some of the details. The first feeding, there were more people. There were 5,000 men, it specified there, so we believe there might have been even more than that. And there was less bread, 5 loaves. Here we see, among this Gentile population, that there are less people. Now it says 4,000, and in the English, they modified it to people. So whatever, it's less. And there's more bread. The leftovers have assigned amounts too, right? The 5,000 leave 12 baskets full. Like, he goes out of his way to mention this. And the 4,000 leave only 7. The baskets, by the way, are another clue that we're in Gentile space, because in the original story of the 5,000, the word for basket is a word for a Jewish-style basket. It's a very specific type of basket. The word he uses in this next one is a common basket that's used all throughout the regions that is not particular to Jewish people. That's another symbol, another sign, another hint that we're in Gentile space. We'll come back to all of this, but the big idea here is Jesus gives a sign, a miracle, in this case, to people who are not insiders. He's in Gentile space. The kind of baskets they have are Gentile baskets. The kind of language he uses says that these are not Jewish people. So this is, Gentile is a word for everybody else, non-Jewish people. That's where he is. And similar to before, it's his compassion that moves him to do what he's doing. Now I have story number 2. Justine, come on up, has a story of a sign that God gave her at kind of a pivotal moment in her faith. And she's going to share that with us.
I have a little sore throat, so that's why I have the mask. I'm going to try to stay on topic with my little notes. So yeah, back when I was in college, I started growing in my faith, learning more about the Bible and that God actually cares about me on a personal level instead of just, you know, the routine with my parents and all that. At the same time, I'm a young person, and a young man started showing affection toward me. He was not a Christian and was actually like staunch atheist. We would talk about God and the Bible sometimes. And since I wanted to be married someday, we would talk about why it would be difficult to be married to each other if that's where our relationship ended up. In the meantime, I'm talking to my Christian friends about this guy and this dilemma I'm having with dating him and him not being a Christian. And they gently discussed with me why the Bible cautions against it. And I was starting to feel convicted by the Spirit about the relationship and how it probably shouldn't go on anymore. But I also like the attention. I'm not getting attention from very many dudes, especially Christian dudes. So basically, I started keeping this a secret from my friends, that I'm not cutting this man out of my life. My friends were like a reminder of God in my life, and I wasn't quite ready to submit everything to him. One night, as I was getting ready for a sushi date with this guy, my friend, her name's Mia, a lot of you know her, she texted me about hanging out with her and her husband to watch a movie with some Christian friends that night. This is normal, a text from her out of the blue to hang out last minute, normal thing. I can just ignore it for now, tell her I'm busy. I keep getting ready. And then a few minutes later, she calls me. Now, that was a little more rare, getting a call from Mia. So I just didn't answer the phone. Because I couldn't lie to her outright. If I just hadn't seen the call, that's fine. I can call her back or text her later. Especially because she would call me out if she knew what my plans were, if why I couldn't hang out. So I could kind of feel that nervousness that you get sometimes when God's trying to get your attention. But I really wanted to get sushi and go on this date. So, like I said, I ignored the call. Just a few minutes after this, which is just a few minutes before he was supposed to pick me up, Mia knocked on my door. Oh, crap. I had to answer the door. She saw my makeup and my cute outfit. I knew now that God was seriously getting my attention. Mia had never knocked on my door before like that, showing up unannounced. Fortunately, she did not pour shame on me. She had the spirit too, so God just gave her wisdom to gently pull me into his love instead of a situation that would, you know, make me reject community, reject God. And she also had been telling me, like, if you keep hanging out with this guy, it's going to be harder and harder to, you know, your feelings will grow. It's going to be harder to not continue the relationship, especially since you know it's probably not for the best. So she gently called me out in that moment. She left my house saying, you know, I will love you either way. And I knew that I had to stop dating this guy. So when he showed up, I told him, like, I can't go on this date. We had to stop this. So this continues to be one of my biggest reminders when I wonder if God is really real or if Jesus actually cares about me. He sent me this very clear sign, three signs, really, three in one. And he did it kindly to my heart. And it, like I said, or like Andy said, it came at an inflection point in my faith. If I had ignored these signs, I probably wouldn't be standing here today. I probably would be maybe following Jesus, but maybe trying to still do my own thing with the way I want to do it. So I had to trust in his good plan for me in that moment. Yeah, thanks for letting me share.
Yeah, thank you, Justine. And you know, a great example of another time God, showing compassion and going out of the way. I mean, Justine was so clear to say, like, this was Mia was like going a little above and beyond her norm. Probably didn't even realize quite why she took that so seriously. But it's interesting, you know, several 4th of July's ago, hanging out with Justine and Shua and Bisbee, and this little romance starts to blossom. And now they have a family, and it's quite clear that God had really good things in store, Justine, right? Out on the path that he was leading you on, which is wonderful. So I think, you know, God gives signs. Jesus gave a sign to these outsiders who were in the middle of nowhere, like that showed them who he was, that he had compassion on them, that he was powerful. And it's encouraging. The people, it says in the scripture, were satisfied. They received the food and they were satisfied, and they must have recognized something about Jesus. And Michaela and Justine in their stories both recognized those as moments that encouraged them, that guided them and showed them who God was. So Jesus gives a sign, but then in Mark's biography, Jesus refuses to give a sign. This is where it gets a little complicated. So reading again, immediately Jesus got into the boat with his disciples and went to the district of Dalmanutha. The Pharisees came and began to argue with him, seeking from him a sign from heaven to test him. And he sighed deeply in his spirit and said, "Why does this generation seek a sign? Truly I say to you, no sign will be given to this generation." And then he left, got into the boat, and went to the other side. So Dalmanutha, interestingly, was kind of a lost place. That's where we believe it is now, until about 2013, interestingly. Archaeologists believe it was very near the town of Magdala, which is where Mary Magdalene would be from. We've kind of known where that is, but it's right where an ancient boat was found. So this boat, some of you may have heard of it. This is it being brought up out of the Sea of Galilee when there had been a drought and the waters were low. And here it is in a museum. It is the oldest example of an ancient boat that probably would have been about it was used either before, during, or right after the life of Jesus, interestingly enough. And so that's what's most famous. So this was found in just a little ways away from Magdala. And then with time, some excavations started to happen in that area. You find something incredible like this, which was found in the 80s, and you start to kind of, you know, poke around. And so in 2013, things like this were found, and some pottery shards. And so this is a stone from a synagogue. So it means that there was actually a community in this place that they didn't realize. There was no evidence of a community there until the boat and this remains of the synagogue, and now they're starting to find more stuff. And archaeologists are starting to think this might be Dalmanutha. This might be that kind of lost town. So that's interesting. That's where they are. And so it makes sense if there's a synagogue that you would find religious leaders. It's the biblical story starts to square up with that. If there was a synagogue in Dalmanutha, you might find Pharisees, religious leaders. So Jesus, they land on shore. How cool would it be if that was the boat, right? Don't you wish we knew? Well, we don't. But they land on the shore and the Pharisees come out and they're arguing with him and they're asking for a sign from heaven, it says, to test him. And Mark has already set the table for us to understand that the Jewish folks of the day that you'd expect to embrace a new and powerful leader like Jesus have officially rejected him. They're not in on Jesus. That has been very clearly stated by Mark. So as we're at this point, we've seen the political leaders, the Herodians, the religious leaders, the Pharisees especially, and their scribes. The Herodians would be those aligned with the Romans and the secular power. The religious devotees, the Pharisees, want to see Judaism and the Jewish race return to their place of power and influence. Either way, those people are all rejecting Jesus. They become antagonistic to Jesus. So if you're reading this biography of Mark and you're reading it straight through, when you get to this story that the Pharisees are confronting him, that's what you expect from Pharisees at this point. You already know they're conspiring against him. They don't like him. They are critical to him. So that's no secret. And there's no secret to their motives here because of that backstory. They have what one commentator called an incurable blindness. They're not only missing what Jesus is doing, they're actually seeing what he's doing, and they dislike it, and they want to stop it. They're not looking to be convinced by the sign. They're looking to critique Jesus. They're assuming that he can't do it, or that whatever he does, that they can find a hole in it and pull it apart. But what we need to notice is it's not just them. We're going to get to that in a second. Jesus does a deep sigh again. Our last story that Eric shared with us last week, there's another deep sigh. It's like all of a sudden Jesus is just doing a lot of Eric was saying, this is Jesus being very human. And I agree with that. I would also say, if you're going to acknowledge the other part of Jesus, that he's the Son of God, this would be him being very burdened by their unbelief and by their opposition to their creator, burdened by the motive, by the reason, by the why. These are people that he made. If Jesus is the Son of God, these are people that he's made, that he's made to worship him, made to love him, made to reciprocate, you know, him for all that he's given them. And they're testing him. They want to take him out. So why do they seek a sign? Well, he asked the question. He says, why does this generation seek a sign? And he refuses to give another sign. But this time, as we go on, you'll see it's not just to the critics. He won't give one to the disciples either. It says he left the Pharisees and got into the boat and went to the other side. There's a lot of crossing this sea. There was a map I found of Jesus's travels in the book of Mark, and the Sea of Galilee is just like a lot of lines. It's like back, forth, back, forth. It says, now they, the disciples and Jesus, had forgotten to bring bread. They only had one loaf with them in the boat. And he cautioned them saying, watch out, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. And they began discussing with one another the fact that they had no bread. I assume they ate it all at this point. And Jesus, aware of this, said to them, why are you discussing the fact that you have no bread? Do you not yet perceive and understand? Are your hearts hardened? Having eyes, do you not see? Having ears, do you not hear? Now, lest we think that these two are disconnected, notice his seemingly strange statement, which was when he just says, beware the leaven of the Pharisees and Herod. Leaven, right? Spreads throughout a lump of dough. Beware of it. And then it was actually prior to their discussion about why they had no bread. He said that first, that warning, before they discussed having no bread. Now, something that this stood out to me as I examined it, I wondered, I assumed that if they discussed the bread, you know, that what they were trying to say was that they weren't sure Jesus could make more bread. That's sort of where my head was at. I assumed they were in the boat and they had their one little loaf of bread and they were like, oh no, we're really hungry. I wonder if Jesus can make bread. But the more I thought about it, that's absurd. Like if the book, you know, is gonna make any sense, he's literally just made thousands of loaves of bread. Like Jesus is a bread factory. He's like a walking bread factory. And I don't think they were there going like, I wonder if he can make bread. I don't think that's what it was. I don't think that's exactly what they discussed. It's just as possible that they knew he could make bread, but they were wondering if he would do it for them, right? For them. And that would be what elicits his response. And that's likely the flavor of it. In that case, they would be being denied the sign for the same reason, in a way, as the Pharisees. And if the Pharisees and the disciples are being denied a sign, then his question, why does this generation seek a sign, applies to all of them. And if we read this as fellow disciples of Jesus, reading the story of Jesus from Mark that's supposed to teach us how to be disciples, we should be asking the question, why do we seek a sign? Also, along with the disciples and along with the Pharisees. See, Jesus didn't just deny the sign to bad people who were trying to disprove him. He also denies his disciples the sign because their hearts may be hard. So what's the issue, right? What's hard to understand? He says, do you not understand? What are they missing? What might we be missing? What are we potentially doing wrong or misperceiving about Jesus and his signs? So here's where we might do well to pause and ask ourselves something. And I just want to let you know I'm comfortable with the silence. In fact, I'm thirsty. I'm going to take a drink here for a sec. I'm going to ask you a question. I'm just going to kind of hang out and take a drink while you think about it. If you were to ask Jesus to do a miracle, what would you want? Right? What would you want? If you could ask him for anything, what would you want? And then why? Why do you want it? So I'm going to hang out and drink some water. You guys think about that for a sec. There are a lot of miracles I'd ask for. There are all sorts of experiences, not unlike hunger, that I'd really like to be delivered from. If I could get rid of like half of the last week, I would. Just wouldn't have done it. The why, though, takes a lot more thought. The what, there's all kinds of miracles I would like to have. I could just dream up fun ones. I could dream up very practical ones that I would love for Jesus to deliver me from and give me, you know, all kinds of stuff. But why? That takes more thought. When I thought about mine as I was writing this, I was thinking about some things like pain or discomfort. That I would like to not deal with, right? I have doubts. I don't know if that surprises you, but I do. And I would really like it if God would do things that would just obliterate them, right? Like when I'm not sure about something, if God would just come in and like, wha-boom, like make it obvious. I would really, really like that. I would like Michaela's billboard daily, right? Like that would be really, really great. It's really hard to parse this out though, because that isn't necessarily wrong, right? If we are made for God, for relationship with God, and to live in a world that is free from the curse, it's natural to desire that the pain would be gone. It's natural to desire that discomfort would be gone, that our doubts would be alleviated. You'd be crazy not to want those things. Like you would not be fully human if you didn't care and want those things to be eliminated. Last week, Eric told us a story about some people, right, who carried their friend who was deaf and mute to Jesus because why? They wanted him to be free from the isolation that his deafness and his muteness had subjected him to. He couldn't communicate. He was alone. His friends wanted him to be free from that, as they should. That man was made for relationship, for freedom, and they should have done that. But at the end of the day, we were made for relationship to who? The world free of the curse is made so that we can enjoy who most of all? God. Back to the story. So they'd forgotten to bring bread. They only had one loaf with them in the boat, and he cautioned them, saying, "Watch out, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod." They began to discuss with one another the fact that they had no bread. Jesus, aware of this, said to them, "Why are you discussing the fact that you have no bread? Do you not yet perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Having eyes, do you not see? Having ears, do you not hear?" It's interesting that Mark puts Jesus' warning before the disciples' discussion about bread, as I mentioned a second ago. It's as if Jesus saw the conversation coming and he's warning them, and then they stumble right into exactly what he warned them not to do. The leaven of the Pharisees and Herod must be an inward influence that they're both impacted by that spreads throughout them and can spread to others. It would lead you to suspect Jesus, to oppose Jesus. But why? We've circled around this all year, but they want these other things, understandable things. Herod, what's the leaven of Herod? Well, he's power hungry. He can be brutal. He's kind of curious about John the Baptist, but at the end of the day, when it's his birthday party and he's at the center of it, he's going to sacrifice John the Baptist. He's going to put his head on a platter, right? He's the puppet king of Israel. He's under Rome's authority. He benefits from it. He derives power from the empire. If he wants God, maybe it's for the imperial benefits. But Jesus, John the Baptist, just can't fit within his framework. The Pharisees see Herod as morally compromised, and he is. He isn't seeking the renewal of Israel or the return of their roots as God's people. But they also oppose Jesus. The Pharisees, as we've learned, they have high standards, high expectations. They believe in the Bible. They see a path forward toward national renewal that comes from good moral behavior, dedication, opposing the outside culture which corrupts God's people, even overthrowing it. They're legalistic. And they struggle with Jesus because he's appealing and authoritative. The signs are getting people excited that he could be God's anointed leader, but he's healing the Romans. He's including the Greeks and the Syrophoenicians, their arch enemies, as we discussed a couple weeks ago. He's gathering tax collectors and sinners and commoners. He's extending mercy to the undeserving. He's including everybody they don't want included, so they can't have anything to do with it. Jesus has announced that he's initiating God's kingdom. His ministry, if we flash back to the very beginning of Mark, he read the scroll in the temple. Remember, a demon-possessed man ran into a synagogue, sorry, not a temple, a synagogue, and yelled, "I know who you are," and it's this dramatic scene. And Jesus was actually reading from a scroll that was saying, "I'm the coming king," essentially, reading out of the book of Isaiah. He's announced that, and the Pharisees and Herodians have decided, essentially, if that's the coming kingdom, and if you're the king, we're out. It's not the kingdom we want. And by extension, Jesus, you're not the king that we want. In fact, you're getting in the way. In other words, they've said to Jesus, "We don't want you." They're saying to God in the flesh, the Son of God, "If this is the effect of getting you, God, I don't want you. I want you if you give me what I want." They want something else that he's promised, land, peace. They want things that he possesses, power, influence, even righteousness, but they don't want God. And how quickly and insidiously that leaven can spread. Here the disciples are discussing that they have no bread. "Jesus, where's our bread?" Maybe they said, "This is unfair. They got all kinds of bread. What about us, right? We're your disciples. What about us?" And notice how seriously Jesus responds. "Why are you discussing this? Do you not understand? Are your hearts hardened? Are they calloused? Don't you see? Can you not hear? Can you imagine getting those responses from Jesus? You're just asking for some, you're just asking for what these people got, right? And he's treating you like the Pharisees who hate him. What in the world? This is not the same, right? The disciples are like, we're your guys. We're just hungry. It's not the same as the Pharisees, or is it? Because the leaven at the core is idolatry. It's when you put anything above God as the ultimate thing in your heart. That's the leaven, whether it's the nation, whether it's righteousness, whether it's the power, whatever it is that you want. And God has it, but if you want it more than God, you've stumbled right into idolatry, which can be described as placing the gift above the giver, the creation over the creator, making a good thing an ultimate thing. It's different in degree, same in substance. The same leaven is beginning to seep in. So Jesus says, don't you understand? And if you're a simple-minded believer like me, and believe me, I read this several times, and I went, no, I don't understand. I don't understand. It takes some work. So all of a sudden, we have to grapple with what was with all the data earlier, the amounts of bread. All of a sudden, that emerges as like, does that have something to do with what they were supposed to understand? Is that why Mark included all those details? It is. It's exactly why. It's not numerology. It's not some mystical meaning of the number 7. I also don't think it's about bread volume. I don't think Mark all of a sudden got just really interested in volumes of bread. I don't think he was just like, guys, you're not gonna believe how much bread there was at this time and then at this time. And the rest of the book of Mark, he doesn't care about that kind of stuff. That's not what it is. But those amounts of baskets matter when they're on theme. There's a reason Mark got into it. Don't you want to know? He was careful to describe it in the first feeding and now the second. So we have to look back at it. The first feeding, there were more people, 5,000 men, so maybe even more than that, right? Less bread, 5 loaves, 1 loaf per 1,000 or so. And then there's 12 baskets left over. At the second feeding, in Gentile territory and outsider territory, there's less people, more bread, and 7 baskets are picked up. Less baskets left over at the end, okay? We learned about the first feeding. It wasn't about Jesus' ability to make bread. He had walked on water right before that. That is like an exhibition that Jesus is a God. So if you have power over the water, it's easy to make bread. I hope that's been established. You can make bread. I've seen some of you make bread. Jesus did that. That's not that impressive. Walking on water, I've never seen any of you do. You'll walk on this, but there's concrete under you. So there's that. It's not a big deal to make bread, right? Bread making's nothing. The miracle is that God was compassionate, self-giving, and God revealed in Jesus that he is a servant king, and he stands out from all the other gods. So think about this. The revelation, that revelation that he was so compassionate, was given to Jewish people on a hillside, 5,000 of them. They had ample evidence to point them to this in their scripture. This miracle should have reinforced a truth that they already knew, that God was mindful of them and compassionate toward them. So what about the amounts of bread? Well, the sign for them was more pronounced. There are more Jews given the revelation, but more of them discarded it. Do you see? Just like with the scriptures, more of them had the opportunity, but more of them discarded it. Just as many, you know, Jewish people here were given the revelation of Jesus' compassion and grace in a pronounced way, exhibited in this bread, and then there's all this leftover. People who said, we don't need it all. To the Gentile outsiders, the sign is great, but it's less pronounced. There's less people, but there's more bread. He gives more to the smaller group of Gentiles, but their receptivity is higher. There's less left over. So Jesus gives way more to a smaller group. They eat way more of it. This is at the core of the meaning of these amounts, is that Jesus is showing, I am giving my compassion and grace out to people. My kingdom is going to be made up of many outsiders. More of them will receive me than you expect. I am very generous to those who are outside. I am throwing open the gates to people who've never heard my name. Don't you understand? This isn't about bread. He's saying, this isn't about you. This isn't about, am I going to get as much as them? This is about, will you see who I am? Will you worship me for my goodness and my generosity? Are you listening? Are you paying attention? This is so often the way that things work, by the way, that we receive signs and we turn them into something else. So if you drive down the back way to Bisbee, one of my favorite drives, you'll drive by Miracle Valley, and there's a big old church there that's kind of rotting away, and the roof's all torn off. It has a big dome over it. And I got really interested in the ministry that was there, because it's called Miracle Valley, and all the names have like spiritual names. And what it was is there was a guy who became very known for healing people. And there was a big movement, and a bunch of people moved to southern Arizona to be close to him, and there was an airstrip and a school. Unfortunately, his ministry ended in scandal. He was an alcoholic. He was hiding it. And all this weird evidence came out that, like, the church had started to make people sign waivers because they knew they weren't necessarily getting healed. So they'd make them sign a waiver that if they didn't really get healed, they wouldn't tell anybody. And all this got out, and it was all in the news. This is a long time ago. And of course, the whole place unraveled. And then there was, because it's Arizona, some form of shootout in Miracle Valley. And, you know, good old Arizona. So that there's that. Then if you've watched the movie Jesus Revolution, similar story. Lonnie Frisbee seems to have had this spiritual insight and some people got healed. But then it became like an obsession. Like he had to be the conduit. He had to be the center. It got in the way of his marriage. It got in the way of a lot of things. It got weird. It got kind of all about him. But in both of those stories, when you really dig into them, early on, there are still people that are like, yeah, but when I first met Lonnie, back when it began, there were some actual healings. Like, and they're like, no, really, there were. And the same thing in Miracle Valley. There are some people that are like, at the beginning, there was some actual miraculous stuff. And I don't know how all of this works, but I have a feeling it's something like this. Don't drive through washes. Now you know. I have a feeling it was something like this, that in the early days, there was this outpouring of the compassion of God and the gathering of the nations. In fact, Miracle Valley was one of the early integrated churches. It was the first televised integrated church. People of all nations were welcome, and they didn't have to sit separate from each other. That was kind of a beautiful thing. And it seems that, and the same is true, right, of Lonnie Frisbee and the hippie movement, right, and the Jesus movement. Some of you are here because of the Jesus movement, right? Hey, not to point you out. But beautiful things happened. It was good. And then it became about something else. That's what we can do when the leaven comes in and corrupts. Jesus can give powerful, wonderful signs, but he wants us to do these things, to enjoy these things, to seek these things because of him. He's the center of it. Not that we would get everything that we want, and not that we would get just his gifts, but we would get him ourselves. So what I loved about Michaela and Justine's story is that the end result was they knew that Jesus cared for them. And I know Michaela's story, and I think I know Justine's enough to know that they have not gone on to have a life of like constant divine revelations every time they pull out of parking lots, right? But they saw at one time when they really needed it that Jesus looked at them with compassion. And that's exactly what we're supposed to see. Now, some have made a direct correlation of these feedings of these people to the Lord's Supper. I don't think it's there, okay? I don't think Jesus was giving them a pre-Lord's Supper, but there is a thematic continuity into our Lord's Supper where Jesus says, I am the bread of life. I am what you need, where he becomes the center of our worship. Because the greatest miracle of all, as they were floating on the Sea of Galilee, was yet to come. And it was the revelation of Jesus that we receive at the cross, that his compassion and mercy to all nations, which is, by the way, why we're here, extended into his willingness to enter into the depths of our suffering, the deepest recesses of our idolatrous hearts. And on the night he was betrayed, he took bread and broke it, and he said, this is my body broken for you. That's to say that your needs, your longings, your idolatries, all the results of the curse, all the results of the broken world are things that he said, I will bear them on my own self because of my compassion. Because I see you and your needs, your deepest needs, and your everyday needs. And I have laid under the burden of all of that brokenness for you. We don't deserve King Jesus. We deserve to pay for our treason. That's what the kids' catechism was ultimately about. But Jesus bore the breaking as he hung on a cross fashioned by the Romans, where he was condemned by his own people and by the Pharisees who taught his Bible in the synagogues. They condemned him, and he hung there, and he said, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they do. And he took the wine from the table, saying, this is my blood of a new covenant, shed for the forgiveness of many. Remember me every time you drink of it. So Christians, we are to remember, in light of the most incredible miracle, greater than the walking on the water, that the God who made us suffered in our place. The ultimate act of compassion, and was raised from the dead to show that he is the God who's at the center of our worship, the only creator and giver of life. His resurrection becomes a signal of hope that his compassion extends into eternity, that we'll be raised with him, not so we get out of hard stuff, that's a wonderful byproduct, but so that we can enjoy him forever, all right? I'm gonna pray now and leave 2 minutes of silence for you to pray, listen to the rain, think about how wonderful it is that we receive that in the desert. To confess to him think idolatries, like let that be a theme. What gift do I place as more important than the giver in my own heart? And here's the thing, this is the invitation of Jesus. He doesn't look down on you and go, how could you? He has compassion and he's ready to forgive. That's the wonderful thing about Jesus. After that 2 minutes of silence, we're going to do the three things that we always do together. We're going to take the Lord's Supper. You'll notice as Josh and Jules get up to sing after that 2 minutes, that I'll come up here and be ready to serve that to you. People will line up on this row right here, and I'll serve that to you, and you would take that in the spirit of receiving Jesus, who's at the center for us. We're going to sing together. Josh and Jules have been so gracious to lead us in that, and that's a time for us to take these truths, let them sink down into our hearts and just revel in them. Giving is always something we remind you of at this time. We will have a tablet in the back in a second. Its battery was dead. Thank you, Cruz, for putting that up there. You can give on the screen. The big idea of this is, like, by the way, like, giving is not supposed to be a guilt trip thing where you help us do all the cool stuff. Giving is supposed to be like an idolatry crushing mechanism, where you say, like, the money that I have to live on, that is my, like, what feels like the most important thing to me, I'm going to say God's given it to me, and I'm going to return some of it to him as an act of worship. And so that's the invitation this evening. Join us in that. And then as a continuation of feasting on Jesus, we are going to feast on potato bar. What is it? No. What's the theme? Potato things. Potato things. That was so close. I knew there were potatoes involved. All right, I'm going to pray and then 2 minutes of silence. Father, thank you for your word, for the depth of it. Thank you for the wonderful compassion that you've had on us in whether it's just, you know, raining down water on our land so that our plants will grow and so our air will be clean and the dust will be tamped down, or whether it's making just miraculous interventions into our lives, like showing Michaela what career to follow, what path to follow, showing Justine that there was a higher priority for her than being liked at that time. You've done those things for all of us, whether we recognize them or not, and we're grateful to you for all of your gifts. Help us to place you, the giver of the gifts, at the center of our worship and not just the gifts that you give. So lead us now as we pray.